readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we're going to get personal. We're going to delve into best-selling biographies and autobiographies, world leaders, fashion icons, entertainers, and regular folks with anything but ordinary tales. And my guest today will tell you how to get started on writing your own biography. Come on, admit it. You know you've thought about it. They say all writers should write their own story first. The time is now. So stay tuned as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
For all of us who've ever lusted after a Chanel bag, Sleeping with the Enemy, Coco Chanel's Secret War, is a new biography by Hal Vaughn that casts light upon the elusive designer and also casts many long shadows. Coco Chanel created the look of the modern woman. As the high priestess of couture, she believed in simplicity and elegance. Even if you've never plunked down the big bucks for couture, Chanel changed the way all women put their look together. In the 1920s, Chanel employed more than 2,000 people in her workrooms and had amassed a personal fortune of $15 million. At the start of World War II, Chanel closed down her couture house and went across the street to live at the Ritz. Her pal, Picasso, called her one of the most sensible women in Europe. She remained at the Ritz for the duration of the war. But. Chanel's life from 1941 to 1954 has been shrouded in vagueness and rumor, mystery and myth. Neither Chanel nor her many biographers have ever told the full story of those years. Now, Hal Vaughn pieces together the hidden years of Chanel's life, from the Nazi occupation of Paris to the aftermath of World War II. Vaughn uncovers the truth of Chanel's long-whispered collaboration with Hitler's high-ranking officials in Paris from 1940 to 44. He writes in detail of her decades-long career with Baron Hans Gunther von Dinklage, described in most Chanel biographies as an innocuous English-speaking tennis player playboy and harmless dupe. However, Vaughn reveals Dinklage as a Nazi spy and German military intelligence agent, master of a spy ring that stretched from Paris to the Mediterranean. He reported directly to Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. Vaughn writes that Chanel became a German intelligence operative and participated in a number of spy missions. He spotlights how Coco escaped arrest in France after the war and how she fled to Switzerland for a 9-year exile with her lover. The French court did open a case on Chanel's espionage activities during the war, but she was able to return to Paris at age 70 and triumphantly resurrect and reinvent herself. This is a fascinating and controversial tale of one of the 20th century's most iconic women. Susan Deniker and Mark Deakins narrate.
A former resistance fighter and husband of English actress Olivia de Havilland, Gallant claimed his information was based on access to French counterintelligence sources. Le Tout Paris was talking about the book before it was even published. Edmond Charroux, a Goncourt Prize-winning novelist, was outraged by Gallant's revelations. She labeled his claims nonsense. Dinklage was not in the Gestapo. Spatz and Chanel, she maintained, just enjoyed an amorous friendship. Madame Charles Roux was also writing a Chanel biography and presumably did not have access to Gallant's sources. Marcel Eidrich, an earlier Chanel biographer, claimed that Spatz was merely a bon vivant who loved eating, wines, cigars, and beautiful clothes. Thanks to Chanel, he had an easy life. He waited for her in her salon. He would kiss Chanel's hand and murmur, "How are you this morning?" And because the two spoke English together, she would say, "He is not German. His mother was English." Asked by Women's Wear Daily, the New York garment industry paper, in September 1972, was Chanel, Paris's greatest couturière, really an agent for the Gestapo? Charles Roux replied, "Dinklage was not in the Gestapo. He was attached to a commission here in Paris, and he did give information. He had a dirty job. But we must remember it was war, and he had the misfortune to be a German." Years later, Charles Roux learned that she had been duped, manipulated by Chanel and her lawyer, René de Chambrun. The liberation of Paris in August 1944 began with bloody street fighting, pitting German troopers against a scruffy, ragtag band of General Charles de Gaulle's irregular street fighters called Force Française de l'Intérieur, the FFI, which Chanel would dub Les Fifi. They were joined by communist fighters Franc-Tireurs et Partisans, FTP, and civilian police officers. Facing German forces, some resistants were armed only with light police weapons. Others had World War I vintage revolvers and rifles. A few had Molotov cocktails and weapons seized from dead Boche. The street fighters were often young students, their sleeves rolled up on bony arms and wearing sandals. Their FFI, FTP, and police armbands served as uniforms. In the last week of August, the U.S.-equipped Free French Army, led by General Leclerc, nom de guerre for Philippe de Hautecloque, relieved the Paris insurgency, and the German garrison surrendered. After 4 years of often brutal occupation, Paris was liberated, free from the threat of arrest, torture, and deportation to concentration camps. Church bells rang, whistles blew. People danced in the streets. Except for some provinces, such as Alsace and Lorraine, France was under General Charles de Gaulle's Free French. A thirst for revenge gripped the nation in the last days of August. 4 years of shame, pent-up fear, hate, and frustration erupted. Revengeful citizens roamed the streets of French cities and towns. The guilty, and many innocents, were punished as private scores were settled. Many alleged collaborators were beaten, some murdered. Horizontal collaborators, women and girls who were known to have slept with Germans, were dragged through the streets. A few would have the swastika branded into their flesh. Many would have their heads shaved. Civilian collabo, even some physicians who had treated the Boche, were shot on sight. The lucky were jailed, to be tried later for treason. Finally, General de Gaulle's soldiers and his provisional magistrates put a stop to this internecine war. The 20th century monstre sacré of fashion, Chanel, was among those marked for vengeance. The French called it épuration, a purge, a cleansing of France's wounds after so many had died and suffered under Nazi rule. Within days after the last German troopers left Paris, Chanel hurried to give out bottles of Chanel No. 5 to American GIs. Then the Fifis arrested her. Truculent young men brought her to an FFI headquarters for questioning.
Tracy Ross never knew her biological father. He had died when Tracy was just an infant. So when her mother married Donnie, a gregarious man who loved the outdoors, 4-year-old Tracy was ecstatic to have a father figure in her life. A loving and devoted stepdad, Donnie introduced Tracy's family to the joys of fishing, deer hunting, camping, and hiking among the pristine mountains of rural Idaho. Donnie was everything Tracy dreamed a dad would be, protective, brave, and kind. But then, His dependence on his 8-year-old daughter's companionship went too far, and everything changed. Tracy writes and narrates her story in The Source of All Things. Once Donnie's nighttime visits begin, Tracy's childhood became a confusing blend of normal little girl moments and sickening secret invasions of her safety. At 16, realizing she must take control of her own future, Tracy escapes to a boarding school and began the long, slow process of recovery. There, in the woods of northern Michigan, Tracy felt called back to the natural world she'd loved as a child. Over the next 20 years, the mountains and the rivers of North America provided Tracy with strength, confidence, comfort, and inspiration. Let's preview her story.
All my dad has to do is answer the questions. That's it. Just 4 simple questions. Only they aren't that easy, because questions like these never are. We are almost to the temple, 3 days deep in the craggy maw of Idaho's Sawtooth Mountains, and he has no idea the questions are coming. But I have them loaded, hot and explosive, like shells in a 30-30. It's July, and hotter than hell on the sage-covered slopes where wildfires will char more than 130,000 acres by summer's end. But we are up high, climbing to 9,000 feet, and my dad, who is really my stepdad, says that this heat feels cooler than the heat in Las Vegas where he lives. 4 days ago, he and my mother met me in Twin Falls, a town 140 miles south of here where I grew up. They'd driven north, across Nevada, past other fires, including one on the Idaho border. When I saw my mom at a friend's house where she'd wait while Dad and I backpacked, she'd seemed even tinier than her 4-foot-11-inch frame. Her sweatpants, plucked from the sale bin at a Las Vegas Abercrombie & Fitch store, drooped like month-old lettuce over her bum. In the creases of her mouth, a white paste had congealed, proof that she was taking antidepressants again. Officially, she has said that she's glad Dad and I are going back to the place our troubles began, 28 years ago, almost to the day. But as I kissed her goodbye, leaving her standing in our friend's driveway, I wondered, which way is the wind now blowing? It was late when we left Twin Falls that night, too late to reach the trailhead to the temple. So Dad and I slept in a field of sagebrush above the town of Stanley. A gnawing in my stomach kept me from eating our black beans and tortillas, but the smell of the sage helped quiet the fear I felt welling beneath my rib cage. In the morning, Dad parked his red Ford pickup at the Redfish Lake Lodge, and we took a boat across the water. On the far shore, we found the trailhead to our destination, which we started hiking toward and have been for the past 3 days. At sunrise this morning, we slid out of our bags, made breakfast, and caught a few fish. When we finally started hiking, we climbed out of one basin and into another, inching up switchbacks sticky with lichen and loose with scree. At the edge of one overlook, we saw smoke rising on the horizon from a fire that was crowning in the trees. And when we arrived at the lake with a dozen black frogs chirping across the water, we called it Holy Water Lake because it was Sunday and we did feel a bit closer to God. Now the wilderness seems haunting and dark. The air is thin, the terrain rugged, and my dad's body, 64 years old, bow-legged, and 15 pounds overweight, seems tired and heavy to me. He's been struggling the last half mile, stopping every few feet to catch his breath, adjust his pack, and tug on the big wet circles that have formed under the armpits of his t-shirt, which reads, "Toot my horn." Ignoring his choice of wardrobe, I try to remember the father who first led me into these mountains. That man was lean, with a light brown mustache and hair that fanned out from his cheekbones and beautiful blonde wings. In a wool-rich shirt and hunting boots, he charged up trails, coaxing me onto ridgelines with views of vast green valleys. If I whined from heat or wilted with hunger, he'd lift me onto his shoulder so effortlessly, it was as if my body were composed entirely of feathers. I know my dad is hurting because I am hurting too, and not just my legs and lungs or the bottoms of my feet. We have barely spoken since we left the dock at Redfish Lake, left the boat and the worried Texans who said, "You're going where?" I'm sure we seemed an odd pair, an old man and his, what was I, daughter, lover, friend?
But Patricia Charpentier has worked as a writing instructor, editor, journalist, ghostwriter, and memoirist. Her popular book, Eating an Elephant, Write Your Life One Bite at a Time, has convinced thousands to get started on their own stories. Patricia offers workshops and seminars and offers sensible, let's get this project going advice. Let's meet her now. Welcome, Patricia. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
How did you become an expert in writing life stories?
Well, I've always had an interest in writing about people. I started writing for a weekly newspaper in my hometown, South Louisiana, when I was 14. And I always liked writing about people. I never liked much about the hard news. In my own life, I had the opportunity to know so much about my family and family history and never really took the opportunity to ask any questions about my where I came from or the people in there. And it was such a great loss to me that about 12 years ago, I decided, okay, I'm going to start trying to do something to help people to write their stories.
So why is your book called Eating an Elephant?
Well, I think it's pretty daunting for people to try to think about how to write their entire life story. It's this huge thing. And when I teach, I'd always talk about that. Okay, you know, it's something that's memorable. It's kind of like, okay, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? And so people would laugh and they would kind of relate to it. And then it provided a framework of how they could take something that was really large and break it down into something that was manageable. Because I think that's part of what keeps people away from even attempting to write their life stories is just the size of the task.
I loved your quote, the only way to do this wrong is not to do it at all. How do you convince reluctant writers to write their own story?
You know, we've all got this like ninth grade English teacher with a red pen sitting on our shoulders. And, you know, whenever we put something down on paper, you know, there's that critical judge that's sitting there saying that's not very good or this isn't correct and I think that's what helps is like giving people the permission to write, to not have to write very well, to be able to put it down however it comes out and to celebrate that.
What do you say to someone who says, I'm not going to write my life, I'm not interesting?
First thing I tell them is that they're wrong, that I believe every life is very interesting. And I've worked with a lot of people. A lot of times adult children will hire me to go out and interview their parents because they can't get their parents to write their story. And invariably, what the children, the adult children want to know are the ordinary things. They don't care about the big, spectacular things. They want to know about what was it like to go to school in when you were growing up, and what did you do for fun? What kind of games did you like to play? What did you eat? What was your favorite food? I mean, very ordinary, common things. And I believe when people realize that, how much interest there is in the ordinary, and how much their families and others do want to know about it, then it opens them up to it, to not thinking that they have to have this exceptional life.
Oh, I've read in your book that writing your life doesn't have to be a linear thing. I was born in December of 1945, and talk about that a bit.
Well, I think that's the kiss of death to someone trying to write their story, is if they have to start when I was born a very young child and, you know, can go systematically through their entire life. I think it's just too daunting of a task. And, you know, what I encourage people to do is just get like a three-ring binder, put dividers in it, one for every decade of your life, and then write whatever happens to be on your mind for that day or whatever you happen to think about. And then you can just put it in the binder where it belongs with the different dividers. And then it's putting an organization on what you're writing, your body of work, but it's not forcing you to write chronologically.
Well, let's talk about your best top five tips, for example, for getting started. Share some of those with us.
The first thing that I would encourage somebody to do is make sure that they have a notebook with them everywhere they go. Little notepads, not sticky notes. I find sticky notes tend to get lost and can take over people's lives. It can definitely take over my life. But I encourage them to have little notebooks by the side of the bed, in the car, in their bag, in their pocket, wherever, because the thoughts come and the memories come at very inconvenient times. So it's good if they can just jot down one or two words that will help them to remember later on when they get to a position, in a position where they can write down. So I really encourage people to do that, to keep a notebook with them. And I'm a very big fan of lists, and I, for a number of reasons. One being, I guess the primary one being, is that to write a list is not a very intimidating thing. We write lists all the time, every day, you know, to-do lists, grocery lists, whatever. So it's not something that's daunting.
What are some of the memoirs or biographies or autobiographies that have been published that really made an impact on you?
Well, one of my absolute favorites is a book by the name of The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. And she wrote about her family, and it was kind of a crazy family. And it was just her experiences, but it was just so beautifully written. And one thing that I liked about it a lot, and I try to encourage my students, and even especially when they're writing about things that are difficult, is she wrote with a complete lack of judgment. And in a lot of cases, if I would say the majority of the book, her family or parents did not come off looking very well, but you never sensed the hint of judgment in it. She just kind of laid out all the facts. This happened, then that. And I think that's a great gift to do it in that way.
Well,
and I love Rick Bragg. He's one of my absolute favorites. He's a Southern boy like I am. And I'm from the South, and just writes with such humor and vividness in his language. There's just a freshness that when I read him, it's like I know that I've not read anything else like him.
Well, Patricia, how can our listeners find out more about you and your writing seminars? Where should they go?
Well, the first place to start would be on my website, and it's writingyourlife.org. And Writing Your Life is all spelled out, writingyourlife.org. And there it talks about all the different classes that are in the Orlando area. I have some online classes, which I'll be expanding soon. Now, I just really would like to encourage people to start, to not wait, and to just start and to write, just to start with the first sentence, and because you never know where that first sentence will take you. So I appreciate the opportunity. I kind of got launched on this crusade about 12 years ago trying to encourage people to do this, and I've seen such miraculous things happen. I mean, healing for the person who's doing the writing, and then connections between family members and conversations that were started that would never have been otherwise. So it's well worth any effort that someone would put into it. The time, what they'll get back will be way more than what they ever put into it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Patricia.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
One of the most popular and mysterious figures in American literary history, J.D. Salinger eluded fans and journalists for most of his life. Now, author Kenneth Slowenski has published a biography filled with new information and revelations garnered from countless interviews, letters, and public records. J.D. Salinger, A Life, presents an extraordinary life that spanned nearly the entire 20th century. Slowinski explores Salinger's privileged youth, long obscured by misrepresentation and rumor, revealing the brilliant, sarcastic, vulnerable son of a disapproving father and a doting mother, and his entrance into a social world where Gloria Vanderbilt dismissively referred to him as a Jewish boy from New York. Here, too, are accounts of Salinger's first broken heart. Eugene O'Neill's daughter Una left him for the much older Charlie Chaplin. And then there was the devastating World War II service, of which he never spoke, and which haunted him forever. J.D. Salinger features all the dazzle of this author's early writing successes, his dramatic encounters with luminaries from Ernest Hemingway to Laurence Olivier, his surprising office intrigues with famous New Yorker editor and writers, and the stunning triumph of The Catcher in the Rye, which would make him both world famous and hasten his retreat into the hills of New Hampshire. Norman Dietz narrates.
The Great War had changed everything. As 1919 dawned, people awoke to a fresh new world, one filled with promise but uncertainty. Old ways of life, beliefs and assumptions unchallenged for decades, were now called into question or swept away. The guns had fallen silent only weeks before. The old world now lay in ruins. In its place stood a new nation poised to assume the mantle of leadership. No place in that land was more anxious or more ready than the city of New York. It was the first day of the first year of peace when Miriam Jillick Salinger gave birth to a son. His sister, Doris, had been born 6 years before. In the years since Doris's birth, Miriam had suffered a series of miscarriages. This child, too, was almost lost. So it was with a mixture of joy and relief that Miriam and Solomon Salinger welcomed their son into the world. They named him Jerome David, but from the very first day, they called him Sonny. Sonny was born into a middle-class Jewish family that was both unconventional and ambitious. The Salinger line reached back to the village of Sudargas, a tiny Jewish settlement, or shtetl, situated on the Polish-Lithuanian border of the Russian Empire, a village where, records show, the family had lived at least since 1831. But the Salingers weren't given to tradition or nostalgia. By the time Sonny was born, their link to that world had nearly evaporated. Sonny's father was robust and motivated, determined to go his own way in life. Typical of the sons of immigrants, he'd resolved to free himself of any connection with the world of his parents' birth, a place he considered backward. Unknown to Solomon at the time, his rebellion was actually a family tradition. The Salingers had gone their own way for generations, seldom looking back and growing increasingly prosperous with each step. As Sonny would one day reflect, his ancestors had an amazing penchant for diving from immense heights into small containers of water and hitting their mark every time. Hyman Joseph Salinger, Sonny's great-grandfather, had moved from Sudargas to the more prosperous town of Tauragay in order to marry into a prominent family. Through his writings, J.D. Salinger later immortalized his great-grandfather as the clown Zozo, honoring him as the family patriarch and confiding that he felt his great-grandfather's spirit always watched over him. Hyman Joseph remained in Russia all his life and died 9 years before the birth of his great-grandson. Salinger knew of him only through a photograph, an image that offered a glimpse into another world. It depicted an elderly peasant brimming with nobility, erect in his long black gown and flowing white beard, and sporting a tremendous nose. A feature that Salinger confessed made him shudder with apprehension.
Great. great soul, Mahatma Gandhi, and his struggle with India deepens our sense of Gandhi's achievements and disappointments. His success in seizing India's imagination and shaping its independence struggle. And his recognition late in life that few of his followers paid more than lip service to his ambitious goals of social justice for the country's minorities, outcasts, and rural poor. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Joseph Lelyfeld shows in vivid detail how Gandhi's sense of mission, social values, and philosophy of nonviolent resistance were shaped on another subcontinent during his 2 decades in South Africa, and then tested by an India that quickly learned to revere him as Mahatma, or great soul, while following him only a small part of the way to the social transformation he envisioned. The man himself emerges as one of history's most remarkable self-creations, a prosperous lawyer who became an ascetic in a loincloth wholly dedicated to political and social action. The author follows the heroic and tragic last months of this selfless leader's long campaign, when his nonviolent efforts culminated in the partition of India, the creation of Pakistan, and a bloodbath of ethnic cleansing that ended only with his own assassination. India and its politicians were ready to place Gandhi on a pedestal as father of the nation, but were less inclined to embrace his teachings. This is a brilliantly researched reconsideration of Gandhi's extraordinary struggles on 2 continents, of his fierce but finally unfulfilled hopes. Mark Bramall narrates.
Often in those days, these were people who'd actually encountered the Mahatma, who'd come into the national struggle fired by his example. So more than a patriotic ritual was involved when they claimed to be his heirs. Yet it was hard to say what remained of him beyond his nimbus. An occasion for asking such questions occurred with the approach of the 100th anniversary of his birth in 1969. Setting out to report on the remnants of Gandhi's movement, I followed Vinoba Bhave, his last full-time apostle, as he trudged through the most impoverished parts of Bihar, then, as now, among the poorest of Indian states, trying to persuade landlords to cede some of their holdings to the landless. Vinoba collected deeds to thousands of acres of barren, untilled, and untillable land. The Mahatma's aging protege seemed stoic, if not tragic, as he saw his doomed mission through to its largely inconsequential end. He became his admirers. That's Auden on Yeats. 3 decades ago, V.S. Naipaul used the line to characterize the decline of Gandhi's influence in his last years, when he was most revered. The combination of piety and disregard, hardly unique to India, lasted as a cultural reflex, surviving the explosion of India's first nuclear bomb. Over time and at a distance, my experiences of South Africa and India ran together in my mind. Gandhi was an obvious link. I found myself thinking again about the Phoenix settlement, to which I returned twice, the second time after it had been burned down in factional black-on-black violence accompanying the death throes of white supremacy, only to be restored with the blessing of a democratically chosen government eager to canonize Gandhi as a founding father of the new South Africa. I then found myself thinking about Gandhi himself, wondering how South Africa helped to form the man he became, how the man he became in South Africa struggled with the reality of India, how his initiation as a political leader on one side of the Indian Ocean foreshadowed his larger disappointment and occasional sense of failure on the other, whether, that is, there were clues to the end of his journey as leader in its beginning. I'm hardly the first to raise such questions, and won't be the last. But it seemed to me there was still a story to be uncovered and told, themes that could be traced from the beginning of Gandhi's political life in one country to its flourishing in another, with all the ambiguity of his legacy in each place. The temptation to retrace my own steps while retracing Gandhi's finally proved irresistible. This isn't intended to be a retelling of the standard Gandhi narrative. I merely touch on or leave out crucial periods and episodes, Gandhi's childhood in the feudal Kathiawad region of Gujarat, his coming of age in nearly 3 formative years in London, his later interactions with British officials on three continents, the political ins and outs of the movement, the details and contexts of his 17 fasts, in order to hew in this essay to specific narrative lines I've chosen. These have to do with Gandhi the social reformer, with his evolving sense of his constituency and social vision, a narrative that's usually subordinated to that of the struggle for independence. The Gandhi I've pursued is the one who claimed once to have been trying all my life to identify myself with the most illiterate and downtrodden. At the risk of slighting his role as a political tactician, a field marshal of nonviolent resistance, or as a religious thinker and exemplar, I've tried to follow him at ground level as he struggled to impose his vision on an often recalcitrant India. Especially recalcitrant, he found, when he tried not just its patience, but its reverence for him, with his harangues on the crime and curse of untouchability, or the need for the majority Hindus to accommodate the large Muslim minority. Neither theme, it turns out, can be explained without reference to his long apprenticeship in South Africa, where he eventually defined himself as leader of a mass movement. My aim is to amplify, rather than replace, the standard narrative of the life Gandhi led on two subcontinents by dwelling on incidents and themes that have often been underplayed.
Malcolm X was one of the most complex and controversial figures of 20th century America. Manning Marable's biography, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, is filled with new information, a sweeping story of race and class in America, from the rise of Marcus Garvey and the Klan to the struggles of America's civil rights movements in the 50s and 60s. Reaching into Malcolm's troubled youth, it traces a path from his parents' activism through his own engagement with the Nation of Islam, charting his astronomical rise in the world of black nationalism and culminating in the story of his assassination. The title is read by G. Valmont Thomas.
For nearly a year, the Autobahn's management had been renting the ballroom to the group, but it remained concerned about its leader, Malcolm X. About 10 years before, he had arrived as the minister of Temple No. 7, the local headquarters for a militant Islamic sect, the Lost Found Nation of Islam, NOI. Later commonly described in the press as Black Muslims, its members preached that whites were devils and that black Americans were the lost Asiatic tribe of Shabazz, forced into slavery in America's racial wilderness. The road to salvation required converts to reject their slave surnames, replacing them with the letter X, the symbol that represented the unknown. Members were told that after years of personal dedication and spiritual growth, they would be given original surnames in harmony with their true Asiatic identities. As the nation's most public spokesman, Malcolm X gained notoriety for his provocative criticisms of both civil rights leaders and white politicians. The previous March, Malcolm X had announced his independence from the Nation of Islam. He quickly established his own spiritual group, Muslim Mosque Incorporated, MMI, largely for those NOI members who had left the nation in sympathy with him. Despite his break, he continued to make highly controversial statements. "There will be more violence than ever this year," he predicted to a New York Times reporter in March 1964, for instance. "The whites had better understand this while there is still time. The Negroes at the mass level are ready to act." The New York City Police Commissioner responded to this prediction by labeling Malcolm another self-proclaimed leader who openly advocates bloodshed and armed revolt and sneers at the sincere efforts of reasonable men to resolve the problem of equal rights by proper, peaceful, and legitimate means. Malcolm was not intimidated by the attack. "The greatest compliment anyone can pay me," he responded, "is to say I'm irresponsible, because by responsible, they mean Negroes who are responsible to white authorities, Negro Uncle Toms." Several weeks later, Malcolm X appeared to experience a spiritual epiphany. In April, he visited the holy city of Mecca on a spiritual Hajj, and on returning to the United States declared that he had converted to Orthodox Sunni Islam, repudiating his links to both the Nation of Islam and its leader, Elijah Muhammad. He announced his opposition to all forms of bigotry. He was now eager to cooperate with civil rights groups, he said, and to work with any white who genuinely supported black Americans. But despite these avowals, he continued to make controversial statements, for example, urging blacks to start gun clubs to protect their families against racists, and condemning the presidential candidates of the major parties, Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater, as providing no real choice for blacks. Most OAAU programs were choreographed as educational forums for the local community, encouraging audience participation. For the February 21 meeting, the featured speaker was Milton Glamison, a prominent Presbyterian minister who had organized protests against substandard schools in New York City's black and Latino neighborhoods. The OAAU had not directly participated, but Malcolm had publicly praised the minister's efforts, and his lieutenants may have desired an informal alliance. Although the afternoon's program had been advertised to begin at 2, by the starting time, barely 40 people had passed through the main entrance. The sparse, early turnout may have been a reaction to fears of possible violence. For months, the nation had been engaged in a well-publicized feud with its former national spokesman, and Malcolm's followers in Harlem and other cities had been physically assaulted. Only a week earlier, his own home, located in the quiet neighborhood of Elmhurst, Queens, had been firebombed in the middle of the night. To guard against a public confrontation, the NYPD had assigned a detachment of up to 24 officers at OAAU rallies whenever held at the Autobahn. One or more policemen, usually including the day's detail commander, would be stationed on the second floor in the business office, where they would have an uninterrupted view of everyone entering the main ballroom. Many of the others were prominently stationed at the main entrance or located outside, directly across the street in a small playground area residents called Pigeon Park. On this particular afternoon, however, not a single officer was at the Autobahn entrance, and only one, briefly, was stationed in the park.
Years after her blockbuster Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood, popular author Alexandra Fuller pulls back the curtain on her glamorous, tragic mother, Nicola Fuller. Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness explores Fuller's parents' childhood and charts the trajectories of their lives through war-torn Africa. Fuller crafts a multi-layered narrative of her mother's life. Nicola was born on the Isle of Skye in Scotland and raised in Kenya. She held dear the kinds of values of white African settlers in those times: loyalty to blood, passion for land, and a holy belief in the restorative power of all animals. The story follows Nicola's magical childhood, a wonderful marriage, the birth of a perfect child. Then, Nicola's husband Tim loses his job, their country Rhodesia falls into strife, and they lose a son to meningitis. As a way to pull herself out of depression, the family drives to the Burma Valley on the Mozambique border and builds a farm there. Once again, their dream collapses. Alexandra interviews her mother at length and captures her voice with remarkable precision. Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness is at once funny, terrifying, and richly exotic. Bianca Amato narrates.
Occasionally, we hear a dog barking from the taverns on the Kafue Road, and soldiers in the nearby army camp shouting to one another or letting off the odd stray bullet. It's all very peaceful. Have another glass of wine, Vanessa suggests by way of comforting me. You never know. Mum might forgive you, eventually. In my defence, the awful book, whose full and proper title can never be mentioned in the company of my family, was not all my fault. I had felt more than a little encouraged to write it, directed even, by Nicola Fuller of Central Africa herself. Having given up on my older sister as a potential writer on account of Vanessa's stubborn refusal to learn how to read or write, Mum settled her literary ambitions on me. I was 5 when she abandoned the arithmetic section of our weekly Rhodesia correspondence school packet. "Look, Bobo," she reasoned, "numbers are boring. Anyway, you can always pay someone to count for you, but you can never pay anyone to write for you." Now, Mum paused and gave me one of her terrifying smiles. "What do you think you're going to write about?" Then she took a long sip of tea, brushed a couple of dogs off her lap, and began to live a life worthy of fabulous literature. 12 years later, Mum reviewed her life and matched it up against the kind of biography she hoped to inspire, something along the lines of West with the Night, The Flame Trees of Theca, or Out of Africa. On the whole, she was satisfied. In fact, all things considered, she felt as if she even may have overdone it in some areas. Tragedies, war, and poverty, for example. However, there remained one glaring omission from her portfolio. There had been no airplanes, and airplanes had featured prominently in the lives of Mum's literary role models. And then, as if by magic, Mum says, my dashing little Sri Lankan appeared. My dashing little Sri Lankan didn't really belong to Mum. Although there were whole moments in the course of her relationship with him when you could have been forgiven for thinking exactly that. And there was debate in the family, some of it quite vigorous, as to whether or not he was dashing. But we could all agree that the Sri Lankan was definitely little. His real name was Mr. Vass, and he said he'd come to Zambia to escape all the pain and violence of his native land. "Then you should feel quite at home with us," Dad said, which made Mr. Vass look at him sharply. But my father said nothing more, returning his attention calmly to Farmers Weekly. On the whole, I took my father's side. "As usual," Mum said. "Didn't the last pilot who stayed with us fly his plane into an electricity pole?" I asked, pouring myself another cup of tea. Without looking up from his magazine, my father said, "I'm afraid so." Mr. Vass wilted somewhat. "Don't listen to them," Mum said, steering Mr. Vass firmly away from the veranda and tilting him across her garden. An encouraged tangle of bougainvillea and passion fruit vines, beds of lilies and strelitzia, rows of lilac bushes and caladiums looming over borders of impatience. Mum's current assortment of dogs gambolled at their heels. "My family bullies me terribly," she said. Mr. Vass patted her arm tactfully, for which the little man was rewarded with a voracious smile. "You and I," Mum foretold, "will show them all what real courage looks like. We will be the Blixen and Finch Hatton of Zambia." Mr. Vass blinked an SOS back at me and Dad from the gloaming. "How's that tea, Bobo?" Dad asked. "Still hot?" "Scorching," I said.
Attenborough, Life on Air, Memoirs of a Broadcaster, is Attenborough's own chronicle of an amazing career as a naturalist and broadcaster, spanning nearly 5 decades and each and every continent. Starting in the early 1950s, when Attenborough joined the BBC, the author recounts his work in front of and behind the camera, spotlighting the natural history programs that made him famous. The early days of nature films were major explorations, kind of akin to the treks of Stanley and Livingstone. Attenborough narrates his own tale, making this a wonderful, enjoyable book. Let's listen.
I'd eaten my sandwich lunch in the garden on the bomb site just over the road and had been back at my desk promptly at 2 o'clock, as befitted the most junior and recently recruited member of the London publishing house for which I was working. And that seemed at least 3/4 of an hour ago. I turned my attention to the galley proofs in front of me. It was a text about tadpoles for primary schools. Interesting in its own way, but hardly, I felt, the sort of work that taxed my hard-won degree in natural sciences. Fitting in the illustrations, using a technology that had not changed significantly since Gutenberg's times, required counting the words, sometimes even the individual letters. I had to tot them up, work out how many would have to be carried forward to the next page, and then wrestle with the various possibilities for trimming the next illustration. Another half hour of this, and I took another glance through the window. The clock hadn't stopped at all. Its hands had certainly moved. They had advanced a few minutes. But it was still not half past. This dismal revelation depressed me so much that I decided to turn my desk around so that I wasn't hypnotized by the hands of a clock. Instead, I stared at a blank wall. And it was then that I decided that this was not the way I wanted to spend the rest of my life. Maybe my future was not, after all, to be a gentleman publisher. But what was it? I was 24. I had studied natural sciences at Cambridge, thinking that somehow research would ultimately take me to remote and exciting parts of the world. Then I had to do my national service. I went into the Navy, hoping that I might be sent somewhere romantic. At Gosport, where we did our preliminary training, I met old naval hands who talked a lot about Trinco. That's to say, Trincomalee, in what was then Ceylon. The Far Eastern Fleet was based there. It sounded good to me, and I told whoever I thought might have some influence in the matter that Trinco was just the sort of place I would like to be posted at the end of my training. In the event, I was sent to join an aircraft carrier that was being mothballed as part of the reserve fleet in the Firth of Forth. By the time the Navy had finished with me, I had decided that I didn't want to go back to university to read for a doctorate. Zoological research in those days was largely laboratory-bound, and that wasn't the way I wanted to study animals. In any case, I had now married Jane, whom I had met at university, and I didn't fancy going back to subsist on a student grant, even if I could have got one. So I had decided that publishing would suit me, and had got myself a job as a junior editorial assistant with an educational publisher. But now that didn't seem to be a thrilling proposition either.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
In Seven Dirty Words, The Life and Crimes of George Carlin, journalist and cultural critic James Sullivan tells the story of alternative America from the 1950s to the present, from the singular vantage point of George Carlin, the Catholic boy for whom nothing was sacred. Seven Dirty Words is an insightful examination of Carlin's body of work as it pertained to the times, from his early days as a more or less conventional comedian to his stunning transformation into the subversive comedic voice of an emerging counterculture. Sullivan also chronicles Carlin's struggles with censorship and drugs, as well as the full-blown renaissance he experienced in the 90s, both personally and professionally, when he became an elder statesman to a younger generation of comics who revere him. And what makes this title even more enjoyable, it's performed by my pal, Alan Sklar.
Just as no topic was off limits for Carlin, no style of comedy was beyond his grasp. He was equally enamored of hokey puns, my back hurts, I think I overslept, and sly brain teasers. If crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? He did street corner insults and Zen non sequiturs. He changed voices, made sound effects, whistled, sang, stuck out his tongue, and blew raspberries. He was an outstanding physical comedian, too, with enough rubbery faces and herky-jerky gestures to do an entire set in mime. Many comedians have distinctive voices, but only a few are fortunate enough to develop one that's never been heard. George Carlin's voice was unmistakable. In his younger years, he had the mellow, quizzical tone of a perpetually amused pot smoker. Later, it aged into a hard-earned rasp. Throughout his various stages, this one-of-a-kind voice, quintessential New Yorker, representative hippie, reflexive contrarian, spoke for a nation of dissatisfied idealists and for himself alone. Timing is essential to comedy, and Carlin's personal timing could not have been more precise. The comic comes into being just when society and the individual, freed from the worry of self-preservation, begin to regard themselves as works of art, wrote Henri Bergson in his famous essay on laughter. Born during the golden age of radio, Carlin devoted more time to reading Mad Magazine, established 1952, than to his Latin and algebra lessons. The stand-up comedy rebirth of the 1950s, when performers including Lenny Bruce, Mort Sahl, Shelley Berman, Jonathan Winters, and Dick Gregory demolished the old order of vaudevillian shtick, gave his early career its context. And Carlin was at that crucial age of transformation, 33, when he found he could no longer ignore the lure of the countercultural revolution. Comedy, as the proud autodidact knew better than anyone, is a constant voyage of discovery. Picking up the baton from the martyred Lenny Bruce, he remade stand-up, once the trade of strip club flunkies in cheap tuxedos for the rock and roll crowd. He took it to theaters, turning the art of the joke into a concert event. Then he brought his provocative routines into the home, rejuvenating his career with an association with HBO that would last three decades. Some comedians can stretch a half hour's worth of one-liners to last a lifetime. Carlin wrote an hour of new material for each HBO show roughly every 2 years. Younger comedians are awestruck by the sheer vastness of his productivity. No one else came close. For most comics, stand-up is a means to an end. In the 1980s, 10 solid minutes got more than a few of their own sitcoms. In the age of television, Carlin was a rare creature, a comedian for whom stand-up comedy was the mountaintop. I found out that it was an honest craft, and in fact, that art was involved, he said. Like a master craftsman, Carlin worked with words. He held them up to the light. He inspected them, rubbed them, and whittled them. He worshipped them in a way that he felt precious few products of the human mind deserved to be worshipped. His most famous routine, 7 words you can never say on television, branded him as a vulgarian, a foul-mouthed comic who worked dirty. But the routine was much more than mere titillation. It was an airtight example of Carlin's belief in the one thing he truly believed in, the power of reason. Why exactly are these few words, out of 400,000 in the English language, off-limits?
Readers, I hope I've got you thinking about writing your own story. This year is flying by. It's October already. Time to get started. As always, if you're looking for suggestions on which stories you should read next, check out my website, bookreportradio.com. All the big titles are there. Thanks so much for joining in today, and see you next week on The Book Report.